Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, our monthly book discussion, our topic this month is Irish literature. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, is with us. Morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Nelson O'Cala Richel, who is the author of five books on Irish literature, the most recent being Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stead, and The New Journalism. He's also professor of humanities at Mass Maritime. Welcome, Nelson. Good to see you.
Oh, thank you.
So I guess in a few weeks, we have St. Patrick's Day. Everybody claims a little bit of Irish heritage, whether you have it or not, right?
This is true. This is true.
So we're going to find out a little bit about Irish literature this morning. And Jill, do you want to go first?
I would be happy to start the conversation. And as always, I discover something in my library that I never knew was there before until I have to get ready for a radio show, and this was one of those occasions. And I discovered this book on the shelf, ready to be checked out to anyone, from 1948, called New Irish Poets, Representative Selections from the Work of 37 Contemporaries, edited by Devin A. Garrity. It is an really fascinating collection because it's people that you might have heard of, but mostly people we have never heard of, even if they had published five books in Ireland. Somehow it never made it to America. And there are some very silly poems. There is a lot of very, very sad poems. I'm just going to share one very short poem, which is one of the lighter poems by a guy named Ewart Milne, who, according to his bio in here, was born in 1903 in Dublin, where he received his education, has been a schoolteacher, a sailor before the mast, and a medical aid volunteer on the Loyalist side during the Spanish War. He has published five books of verse. He is married and now lives in Essex, England. And I have noticed, in also putting together this show, a lot of Irish move around for one reason or another, happily or unhappily, as the case may be. But listen to this sort of sweet poem about a cat. It's called Diamond Cut Diamond. Two cats, one up a tree, one under the tree. The cat up a tree is he. The cat under the tree is she. The tree is Wychelm, just incidentally. He takes no notice of she. She takes no notice of he. He stares at the woolly clouds passing. She stares at the tree. There's been a lot written about cats by Old Possum, Yeats, and company, but not Alfred de Musset or Lord Tennyson or Poe or anybody wrote about one cat under and one cat up a tree. God knows why this should be left for me, except I like cats as cats be, especially one cat up and one cat under a witch elm tree. So there's a little Irish poetry to start the show today.
Say, leave it to you to start with poetry, right?
Right. This is New Irish Poets, and new meaning not so new any longer, but very new in 1948.
All right. Thank you. Nelson, what's your
To go along with the poetry, and we're going to have to, if we're dealing with Irish literature and we're going to deal with poems, we have to allude to William Butler Yeats. Yeats was an important poet from the late 1880s right up to his death in the late 1930s, and went through various phases. One of his early poems, probably one of the most famous, is The Lake Isle of Innisfree, which has echoes from Henry David Thoreau, if we listen to it. And I'll just read the last stanza from that poem. It's a fairly short poem. But I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. When I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. And Yeats, that last few lines, particularly where he goes through this whole sense of being one with nature, and yet he takes us into where he is. He's on the pavement. He's in a city, which seemed to be an urban, and he talks about the Irish essence being in the deep heart's core, which sort of becomes a motif in a lot of early Yeats's poems. He goes to another phase right after the Great War, 1919, after the Easter Rising in Ireland in 1916 and starting the War of Independence. He writes The Second Coming. And so listeners who knew the HBO series Sopranos might recall the very last episode where Yeats's poem The Second Coming is a motif that runs through it thematically. So it's really, nobody ever mentioned that.
I watched The Sopranos. I don't remember that.
Yeah. it's one of the I think the daughter is studying it in, in university,
okay,
and it keeps talking about it and keeps bringing it into it. And there's lines from the poem, the center cannot hold, and all of that, the chaos loose, and you know, it ends with the lines and what ruffed beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Very much an apocalyptic.
You know, that's brilliant though, isn't it? To use that in the last
episode. Yeah, it is, because it ties in so well. And I've never heard anyone, you know, everyone talks about that last episode. I've never heard anyone actually mention it. It's floating in there, and it's in there throughout.
So what's the name of that book?
Well, this is the collected poems of William Butler Yeats, and which Macmillan publishes it, and it'd still be around.
I imagine it would be around everywhere still.
He's a major poet, and you know, and he's got. For the Municipal Gallery Revisited, he ends with the very famous lines, think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say, my glory was I had such friends. So, you know, we've probably all heard that at some point.
Great. All right. Thanks. Jill?
Well, I just wanted to mention about the poetry book that I had been just speaking of, that it also has these incredible woodblock illustrations. And Nelson was telling me that this is actually sort of a tradition.
Yeah, it's the woodblocks. They've been used a lot in Irish publishing, in Irish and in the poetry, but also in nonfiction. And so a lot of the publishing that started to gel in the early 20th century in Dublin, and then expanded from there.
So if you're not interested in the poems, there's great artwork in here as well, which is really spectacular. I have brought I decided to try to look at some very modern Irish things as well as the older things. And there are a lot of really fabulous young writers in Ireland right now who are making a big splash, like a big splash. And in fact, the book that I am reading right now is in fact called Milkman, a novel by Anna Burns. And this in fact has just won the Booker Prize. And it is a really fascinating story about this woman in Ireland. Here's the sort of basic plot, as given by Sam Sachs, who's a Wall Street Journal reviewer. There is no totalitarian state apparatus, no all-seeing big brother as skilled in surveillance and infiltration as a jealous man determined to win a girl. If you don't believe it, ask the narrator of Anna Burns' newly crowned Man Booker Prize winner, Milkman, set in the psycho-political atmosphere of Northern Ireland during the Troubles of the 1970s. And one of the things that is most talked about this book, which I will sort of get out of the way, is that the characters have no names. Mm. And there is the middle sister, and there are people that are in here, but the maybe boyfriend. There is not a single character.
How do you keep track?
Well, this is one of the issues with this novel. And I did not find it, as I'm reading it, I don't find this a problem at all, but I have spoken to people who have found it a big problem that no character has an actual name other than the narrator's nicknames. But because the narrator is so funny in so many ways, and I think this is true actually of a lot of these books that I've been reading with Irish authors, is there's a lot of great humor in them as well. And so here is a little bit. This particular narrator reads a lot when she walks. And so I think I was so charmed by her, by page two, that I wanted to read more about what she was going to say. Now, this is not actually a very happy and light story at all. I don't want to mislead anyone. It's very dark, but she is very funny. So here's a little bit about her walking and first meeting the milkman, as he's called. And the milkman is this very dark character, actually, who is stalking her. I didn't know whose milkman he was. He wasn't our milkman. I don't think he was anybody's. He didn't take milk orders. There was no milk about him. He didn't ever deliver milk. Also, he didn't drive a milk lorry. Instead, he drove cars, different cars, often flash cars, though he himself was not flashy. For all this, though, I only noticed him and his cars when he started putting himself in them in front of me. Then there was that van, small, white, nondescript, shape-shifting. From time to time, he was seen at the wheel of that van, too. He appeared one day driving up in one of his cars as I was walking along reading Ivanhoe. Often, I would walk along reading books. I didn't see anything wrong with this, but it became something else to be added as further proof against me. Reading while walking was definitely on the list. So she spends a lot of time talking about what she's reading, and she has this maybe boyfriend who she calls maybe boyfriend because she's not sure he's going to be the boyfriend. And he has there's a very funny section about his house, because his house is not all she might think it should be. She writes, I saw a program on TV years after I'd been split from maybe boyfriend about people who hoard things but didn't consider they hoarded things. And although nobody was hoarding car, I couldn't help noticing a similarity between what these individuals were doing all these years forward during what is now the era of psychological enlightenment and what maybe boyfriend was doing way back when enlightenment didn't yet exist. And she goes on to talk about everything he hoarded and what other people were hoarding. There's also a really funny section about her French class. I mean, so there's a lot of humor in this. However, there's a lot of darkness because this man is coming after her, and it is...
Is it kind of a thriller with him?
It is a little... Yes, there is certainly a thriller piece to it. And one of the things that Sam Sachs says in his review about this book, that is in Britain, where hand-wringing about literary prizes is a national pastime, debate has arisen as to whether Milkman is too formally challenging for the average reader. The implied accusations of elitism are strange and somewhat depressing because the novel is not at all difficult to read or understand. Critics are right, however, in noting that it's not structured as a conventional drama, but rather as a monologue. And so she is narrating the entire thing. And what this is, again, got, you know, it's won prizes, gotten great reviews. But this is just to tell you that you cannot please everybody with any book that is written. People have loved this, admired this. But I love this line, which is from the New York Times review written by Dwight Garner. And I find this shocking. But, you know, not every book is for everyone. And he wrote... of this book, Burns expands this material into a willfully demanding and opaque stream of consciousness novel, one that circles and circles its subject matter like a dog about to sit, while rarely seizing upon any sort of clarity or emotional resonance. I found Milkman to be interminable and would not recommend it to anyone I liked. So you cannot always please everyone. Yeah. I think it's an amazing book. It's called Milkman by Anna Burns.
All right. Thank you, Jill. Nelson, what's next on your list?
Well, we can't, just because I'd sort of direct my thinking that we can't overlook Irish drama, which has been a phenomenal force since the early 20th century, but even before that in various trends. You know, from powerful writers of contemporary, such as Marina Carr, a great play by the Boggart Cats in the late 90s, phenomenal work. And we can go back again to Yeats. Yeats wrote plays, but also John Millington Synge. And, you know, going along with the idea that we can't always please everyone, there's a great tradition in Irish drama, certainly, where some plays would result in what we might call a riot or a disturbance. And certainly with Synge's The Playboy of the Western World in 1907, had that in the third performance. Audiences stood up and they started shouting at one another and shouting at the actors. And again in 1926 with Sean O'Casey's The Plow and the Stars, same type of disruption. And Yeats, who was one of the directors at the Abbey Theatre, came to the stage and said out to the audience, "You've disgraced yourself again."
What were they objecting to?
They're objecting to the politics. And certainly with O'Casey's play, it was on the Easter Rising in 1916. It was in the 10th anniversary. And some of the folks who remembered that rising or had relatives in it or actually had fought in it felt that some of his portrayals were not as kind as they might like to have thought. And he had different ideas. And one of the things O'Casey was trying to get to was that the poor had been overlooked by all of the politics in Ireland. And so he was trying to address that. In Singh's play earlier in 1907, Singh was Playboy of the Western World, was trying to bring in Ireland as he saw it, which meant that would have everything that would be involved in the Irish. There would be there'd be sex in it. There'd be romance. There'd be greed, all sorts of things. And he puts that into the play. And a lot of people thought that the portrayal of women was inappropriate in the play, and there was a movement to sort of think of Irish womanhood as pure. And of course, Singh, that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, he was trying to move towards more of a modern view. But also, there's playwrights such as George Bernard Shaw that mm-hmm. we can never really overlook. Most of the plays, he wrote them in London for London audiences. But even plays that are not set in Ireland have great resonance. And he always wrote. Dick Dietrich of Shaw Society had noted at one point that Shaw always wrote as an Irishman, and there's certainly can see some of that. But his plays, John Bulls of the Island, a great play from 1904, which sort of takes the images of what is Irish and what is English, and brings them together and looks at them. There's a wonderful, comical scene in the play where there's two characters, both working class, a valet for the English Broadbent, an English valet from East London originally, and a rural Irish laborer who's now acquired some land, and they get into an argument over who has suffered more. And it's very, very funny. And of course, Shaw's point is that they really should see that they're more similar than they are apart. And that's what he was trying to get to in some of that play. Mm. But it's a very funny play.
And still being performed a lot.
Yeah.
Yes?
It is. Well, certainly Shaw's being performed a great deal. And John Bulls on the Island, it sometimes is. It's not as performed as much as it would as it should be. But the English character, Tom Broadbent, who comes to Ireland as a civil engineer, and he's going to redevelop it. And he comes and he has this guidebook with him, and he's looking at various things in Ireland. He comes across this large stone, and he thinks that this must be the stone of Finn McCall, going back to the ancient Irish mythology. And of course, the Irish characters here have no idea what he's talking about. And Father Dempsey is the parish priest in it. And he says, don't believe any such nonsense, sir. There never was any such thing. When people talk to you about Finn McCool and the like, take no notice of them. It's all idle stories and superstition. And then Broadbent says, well, you don't suppose I believe it, do you? And Father Dempsey, I thought you did. But do you see the top of the round tower there? Well, that's an antiquity worth looking at. And the round towers were these very long towers, stone, that were built in monastic settlements in Ireland in the 8th, 9th century. And yet, even though the church kept very good records, there's no indication of exactly what they did with these towers. Hmm. So there's always a bit of, you know, what they are. So Broadbent, reading this in the tour book, said, "What have you any theory as to what the round towers were for?" And Father Dempsey says, "A theory? Me?" And then another character says, "Well, Father Dempsey is the priest of the parish, Mr. Broadbent. What would he be doing with a theory?" And we thought that was a wonderful, very comic scene. But Shaw, like most of Shaw's play, he always works in the serious side of everything. And tries to get to the issues of what's really happening in Ireland, and one of the characters, Larry Doyle, who's been in England for a long time, has come back, and he's talking they're discussing what's a character, Patsy Farrell, who represents rural labourers, and there's a concern of everyone seemed to be abusing him, and Larry says, "Well, because it was by using Patsy's poverty to undersell England in the markets of the world that we drove England to ruin Ireland. And she'll ruin us again the moment we lift our heads from the dust if we trade in cheap labour. And serve us right, too. If I get into Parliament, I'll try to get an act to prevent any to prevent any of you from giving Patsy Farrell less than a pound a week. But the idea of trading in cheap labor, of course, a profound idea, and rings with Shaw's lean towards socialistic ideas in the early 20th century. Although I say that word now, and we get all upset about.
And so, the name of that book again?
That's John Bull's Other Island, I would say on behalf of plays, and particularly Shaw's plays, we might, some folks might think, well, they're really meant for the theater. Yes, absolutely. But they also, a great play reads well. Mm. And it's often been said of Shaw's plays that he wrote the plays to read like novels.
And
they really do read well.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list this morning of Irish literature. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book discussion, and our topic this month is Irish literature. With us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson O'Callaghan Rochelle, who is the author of 5 books on Irish literature, the most recent being Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stead, and The New Journalism. He's also professor of humanities at Mass Maritime. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have suggestions for our list. And not to worry, we will have a link later today to all the books we talk about, so you don't have to madly write them down. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Irma in West and East Falmouth says, I recommend Tiernan's Way by Richard Rook. Mystery, art, friendship, love. Well written. First novel by a lawyer from Wrentham. I read the first draft. Thank you, Irma, for that suggestion. Jill.
All right, here's another fairly new book, a novel called Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither by Sarah Baum. And I have to say, the first thing about this book that I loved was all this language that I had no idea what actually these words meant, and I haven't had time to look them all up. But I mean, in context, they work, but they're just, the language is so delightful in this book. So here are just a few examples of things that are in here. Punnets of chips. I don't know what a punnet is. And a chip, of course, is a fry, like a fry, but punnets, I'm not sure. Scour and chump. Wonkety. Chunterings. Squiddy waterfalls, planky souls, too frail to hoik a lawnmower. So you get all this great language in this novel, but the novel itself is also somewhat unusual and somewhat heartbreaking. And it is about this fellow who lives on his own. He is not quite right, and you never know quite what's wrong with him, but he has not been allowed to go to school. His father has died, and he has been living in his father's house with all of the stuff of the father's house for some time. And at the beginning of the book, he ends up bonding with this shelter dog, this dog who is a one-eyed dog. And as Ray, who describes himself as old, he's 57, shabbily dressed and sketchily bearded, pitching and clomping when he walks, he first sees the dog in an animal shelter advertisement, a grisly photo of a mangled canine face. The kennel keeper says the dog attacks other dogs. Its scars suggest it was used for badger hunting. And as it also, this review goes on to say, Ray is familiar with abuse. His father, understanding Ray is not right-minded, raised him in confined isolation. Ray reads, drives, and knows he's not a regular person, but following his father's death, he's in the house, and he adopts this dog. And they decide that they have to go on the road. And so most of the story is told about the man and the dog being on the road. But there are all kinds of fascinating adventures that they have. And it's so interesting in reading this because you really never, ever learn what's exactly wrong with the man who's the center of the book. But he and the dog are this, it is like this love story between the guy.
Heaven, yeah,
absolutely. Between he and the dog. And you grow to love him. You start at both the dog and the man, because you start out thinking, how am I ever going to read this book about this very odd man? But his love for the dog is so strong that you become completely hooked by the whole thing. And they go all over the place. It's just delightful. And also, however, very dark. I mean, it is not exactly a happy story by any means. But that centering love is really great. Not to mention, there's a great little bit about librarians because, you know, every book I love has some great little bit about a librarian. And he narrates, the fellow at the center narrates, today I find a book about he's talking about the mobile library because the mobile library comes every 2 weeks on a Thursday. And it smells like furniture polish and sticky-fingered children. Today I find a book about blood sports. I flick to the chapter on badger baiting and stand with my back as a bent shield to the librarian. The driver's out on the seafront smoking, and there's nobody else in the bus. Spring, the book says, is the season of digging out. I think I knew this already, but I can't remember why. Spring is when the sows give birth and become especially aggressive. I skip down a few lines. Badger cubs are pulled from the earth as trophies and given to the diggers to rag about amongst themselves to finish off. It's the adult badgers captured in the woods that are kept for the baiting den, those still fighting or trying to fight. I skip down another few lines until I reach the part I know I'm looking for. The diggers often end up with their bottom jaw clean off and a bleeding too great to be stemmed, at which point they're clubbed to death with a shovel and rammed back into the ransacked set. Now an old woman, who is one of my neighbors, totters up the steps of the bus. At the top, she straightens her blazer and makes for the shelf of romance novels in enormous print. I snap my book shut and fumble it back. I check out one about Zen Gardens instead, a collection of Indian folk tales, and Silas Marner again. As the librarian stamps my card, I wonder what a baby badger's called. A calf? A cub? A kitten? Already, I can't remember. So this narrator has this very strong voice and is very interesting guy, and it is done by seasons. So by the end of the book, he is in fact back home with the dog. But it is this journey they take together that is really quite moving.
All right.
It's called Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither by Sarah Baum.
All right, thank you, Nelson.
Well, we can't. We have to at least also mention James Joyce. I keep bringing
up all
these old figures from the past, but
people are familiar with them.
But you know, almost in every review one reads of any new book, they somehow mention those old authors.
They
are absolutely still so part of the scenery.
Yeah, and Nelson impact. These older authors had impact on the newer authors.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly Joyce would always be there for the fiction. I mean, he opens up so many doors in Irish fiction. But there were other Maria Edgeworth in the early 19th century was also a contemporary of Jane Austen's and an important Irish novelist for the period. And I think probably, you know, when we think of Joyce, we often think of Ulysses, that massive
intimidating
novel.
which for those, I have to say, for those that don't know, having at one time read this aloud with my friend, one of the things one doesn't know until one reads it is it's got a big play in the middle of this.
Yes, and the perspective shift and change, and Joyce does all sorts of interesting things with it, I suppose. But it probably, you know, it is a daunting novel to encounter, but perhaps more accessible would be his collection of short stories, Dubliners. And written between 1904, 1907, first published 1914. He had a lot of trouble getting it published. It was originally going to be published in Dublin, and at the last minute, copies were printed, and the publisher decided they were concerned that they'd be hit with libel suits because you could recognize people that he has in the stories. So that there was they sort of backtracked from that. The stories in it are fabulous. Particularly, I think one of my favorites would be From the Dead, the last story in the collection, which was the basis for John Huston's last film, which is a pretty good film with some fine Irish actors in it, Donald McCann, for example. But it's we've got Gabriel Conroy and moving through the whole sense of living and dying or living in death, and you know, towards at the end of the novel, Gabriel, who's totally misinterpreted his wife and partner Greta, and comes to the realization that he really doesn't know her, doesn't know anyone. And we've got and after she drifts into sleep, near the second last paragraph or so, he said, "Generous tears filled Gabriel's eyes. He had never felt like that himself towards any woman, but he knew that such a feeling must be love. The tears gathered more thickly in his eyes, and in the partial darkness he imagined, he saw the form of a young man standing under a dripping tree. Other forms were near. His soul had approached that region where dwell the vast hosts of the dead. He was conscious of, but could not apprehend, their wayward and flickering existence. His own identity was fading out into a gray, impalpable world. The solid world itself, which these dead had once time reared and lived in, was dissolving and dwindling." It's Irish literature, by its nature, often can have great humor, but it also tends to have a dark side, and some more than others.
That sort of seems a theme we're hearing this morning.
Yes,
but a dark side.
right.
Yeah, I mean, we could think of it historically as going back to the colonial period on English rule, but of course that's been cast off for a long time, but then it becomes the post-colonial issues of identity. And I think, you know, we're hearing that in some of the contemporary novels. Of where the characters are, and they're floating, and there's a sense of a disconnect, and still trying to reach that identity and find a cohesion in Irish literature and Irish society. But Ireland is a fascinating country. Its current president, Michael D. Higgins, is a poet, so it's sort of a surreal thing to contemplate. Particularly in our world or our country, but you know, we could carry Irish literature as well into this country. There's certainly a rich Irish American tradition,
Especially in this area of the country.
Yeah, of course. And Partick Colum, a famous Irish poet, lived in Woods Hole for a long time, I believe he died here in 1972, Eugene O'Neill would have been a playwright that had ties to Ireland, was very conscious of those ties in some of his plays and some of his work, but also Alice McDermott in Charming Billy, a fascinating novel from 1998. There's that sense of we can cross into the Americans field with that, because William Kennedy too is another novelist that comes up. We think of Irish American literature and so forth.
Let's talk to Irma, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Irma. Irma, are you there?
All right.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Irma. Is this the same Irma who recommended Tiernan's Way?
When you're put on hold, I can't hear you.
Oh, that's good to know. We'll have to look into that. So, I saw your email, Tiernan's Way by Richard Rooke. We've mentioned that one, and you've read it.
Today.
I'm sorry?
That's all I have today.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for the suggestion, Irma. I appreciate it. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a suggestion in Irish literature for our book list this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book discussion. Our topic this month is Irish literature. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson O'Callaghan-Richel, who's the author of 5 books on Irish literature, the most recent being Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stedden, The New Journalism. He's also professor of humanities at Mass Maritime. 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tom is calling from Harwich. Hi, Tom.
I was was listening, and you were talking about Irish American authors. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've ever heard of J.P. Dunleavy.
J.P. Dunleavy, ringing a bell. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
The Ginger Man.
Yes. Yeah. He recently passed away. Maybe a year or two. A very fine writer.
Yeah. Yeah,
Ginger Man's an excellent.
Funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I believe Ginger Man was banned in Ireland for quite a long time.
It was. Ireland went through a period of great censorship once independence was achieved. It went through a very conservative period, and there was a lot of state censorship influenced by the Catholic Church, which had taken a very strong hold of the country, and that would have lasted 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, moving into the 1960s. I was just reading yesterday that went into films as well. Apparently it's 40 years since Monty Python's The Life of Brian came out, and it was banned in Ireland when it
really?
First came out
and
was not shown there until 1987, so
wow.
8 years after it came out. And you know, it seems silly now we think back on that, but the censorship was a serious issue.
Well, Tom, do you have a favorite book by him?
I would have to say I just finished The Onion Eaters, and it's hilarious. But there's a book that he's written about describing all of Ireland called A Singular Country. And he knows the country well enough to take the piss out of it, so to speak.
That'd be a good Irish phrase.
Tom, thanks for the suggestion. Appreciate that.
Falmouth Library has quite a few of his books there.
Okay, good to know. All right, thank you, Tom. 866-999-4626 for your suggestions on Irish literature. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Anne is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. I have a question. Do your speakers have a quick top 10 list or top 5 list for those of us who need an introduction to Irish literature, to plays and poems in particular?
Yeah.
And I'll take the answer offline.
Okay, thank you for calling in. And I would say all the books we're talking about today would be part of the top whatever
five.
List we have here. And we will have a link to all the books we talk about this morning at our website a little bit later this afternoon. Jill's going to put it together after the show. 866-999-4626 is our number. thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Jill.
And perhaps we can get Nelson to give us his top 5 off air, and I will post that if he's able to do that. But it's very hard to choose. It's a noble effort.
And that list would change if I asked you tomorrow.
Of course.
Give me a list today and it'll change tomorrow.
Yes, I had made up a list last week and it was changing this morning.
Right.
8 o'clock, it was still changing.
That's what happens.
All right, Jill, what's your next book?
My next book is the perfect book after what you've been talking about. It's called Conversations with Friends, a novel by Sally Rooney. And what makes it perfect is all the influence she has from all the authors you've been speaking of and more. She is clearly very well read in Irish literature. And she is very modern. She has just gotten a second book is just about to come out. And what I see in her is this deeply, someone who is deeply read and also doesn't necessarily want anything to do with the old Ireland because she is very much about the new. But her epigraph to this is, her novel is by Frank O'Hara, big story writer. In times of crisis, we must all decide and again whom we love. And she also has this conversation in the novel about the very basic plot of this novel is that there are these two college women. They have been lovers. They are still sometimes in love, sometimes not in love, but they are writing poetry together. They meet this other couple, a photographer it's a married couple. She is a photographer. He is an actor. The young women end up becoming very close friends, and then our narrator, in fact, becomes the lover of the gentleman in the other couple. And there are all kinds of questions that one might ask about this. But what is interesting is how she makes this all possible. I mean, that it all seems real as she's writing about it. But she also talks, so she's talking about Nick, who is the guy who she is seeing, this married man who is an actor. And Yates comes up in the conversation. So she writes, the piece made no mention of a scene. This is a scene in the book in which Frances, the narrator, and one of a quartet of entangled friends tells Nick, with whom she's having an affair, that she recently slept with a guy she met on Tinder. Nick, chopping onions, asks what he was like. "He was awful," Francis answers. "He told me he loved Yeats. Can you believe that?" I practically had to stop him reciting "The Lake Isle of Innisfree" in the bar. "Wow, I feel terrible for you. And the sex was bad. No one who likes Yeats is capable of human intimacy." So she's clearly read her Yeats and responding in her own way. And it is that sort of, and that actually was, I think, a texting that they were having. There's a lot of texting in this novel. It is a very of the moment sort of narrator, and it can be very confusing if you're not, you know, but it also, another thing she does, which drove me crazy, but may not try. I just say, I did actually enjoy this novel, and she's been getting, you know, lots of tremendous press, and the new one comes out shortly. But she, for reasons I do not understand, refuses to use quotation marks. So there's all this conversation that's going on, and you know it's conversation because of how it's written, but no quotation marks. Huh. And much of the novel is, in fact, written in, there's a lot of texting going on. So there are a lot of the conversations are back and forth between two people who are texting to one another. But she also, and in one of these texting conversations, and this is, there have been not one, but two big articles written about her in The New Yorker, one just recently, and one for this novel that I'm mentioning. But there's this back and forth, and the author in The New York article writes, "This exchange, so rigorously serious as to be comic, calls to mind another pair of brilliant Dublin students, Cranley and Stephen Dedalus, who stroll around in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, arguing over the Eucharist and apostasy. Cranley and Dedalus came of age in an Ireland riven by religious strife. Bobby and Frances, the two women in this novel, in an Ireland gutted by the 2008 financial collapse. Capitalism is to Rooney's young women what Catholicism was to Joyce's young men, a rotten national faith to contend with, though how exactly to resist capitalism when it has sunk its teeth so deep into the human condition remains an open question. To be anti-love, as Frances declares herself, is as ideologically satisfying as it is emotionally untenable, a weak position that Bobby pounces on with startling pitilessness." Mm. So it's not that they haven't been influenced all of these authors. And I do recommend this book. It is called Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney. And I am really looking forward to reading her next novel, which comes out in a couple of weeks. I think it's coming out here in April.
Charles writes in, he suggests The Star of the Sea by Joseph O'Connor.
That is in my pile of books.
Is it?
I'm so glad you mentioned it.
Well,
yes.
Well,
I will just say
that,
yeah. And I will, yes.
All right, Nelson.
Yeah, O'Connor's a very important writer in the last 10 years in Ireland. And I've written a number of really interesting works. One other thing that we haven't mentioned any nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And there's a very classic Irish nonfiction work. Again, it's a little old, so yes, I'm
okay.
Antiquated
it's
and
okay.
All that. But this is John Millington Synge's The Aran Islands, which was based on three to four visits that he undertook between 1898 and 1901 to these remote islands in the west of Ireland off Galway. And he writes of the Irish life, and I think, you know, some of our listeners might find that rather interesting, how he depicts the island life. He works into it. He sees a lot of elements of historical past, even pagan traditions, and as well as mixed with Christian ideas and so forth. It's a really interesting work. And the original issue has a lot of illustrations from by Jack Yeats, and Jack Yeats did the woodcuts, and he was William Butler Yeats' brother. So a very talented family, the Yeats, and the father was a portrait painter, and who's died in upstate New York, and I think he's in Schenectady.
Yeah. Right. And the title again?
The Aran Islands, a fascinating book, and on the island life and how he sees all of it. And I'll just read one section of it, because it's with a lot of Irish literature, the poverty sort of mm-hmm. works its way through. And but he writes the grief of the keen, and the keening was a mourning ritual that was performed in the west of Ireland, particularly at this time. It had pagan roots to it. It was usually performed by women, and it would go into a Gaelic chant for the dead. So, the grief of the keen is no personal complaint for the death of one woman over 80 years, but seems to contain the whole passionate rage that lurks somewhere in every native of the island. In this cry of pain, an inner consciousness of the people seems to lay itself bare for an instant and to reveal the mood of beings who feel their isolation in the face of a universe that wars on them with winds and seas. But there's that sense, too, that sort of moves through there, and I think we've heard a lot about it this morning, of a sense, again, with that notion of isolation.
Right. Are you going to tell us about Star of the Sea?
Well, what I was saying about Star of the Sea is we did this with our book club one month several years ago now, and it was so astonishing in that it was, again, this history. It's historical fiction. And as it says in the blurb, in the bitter winter of 1847, from an Ireland torn by famine and injustice, the Star of the Sea sets sail for the New World. On board are hundreds of refugees, some optimistic, many more desperate. Among them are a maid with a devastating secret, the bankrupt Lord Meredith and his wife and children, and a killer stalking the decks, hungry for the vengeance that will bring absolution. And it is a great telling of Irish history. I knew really little about the Irish famine until I read this novel. And as it happened, I was going to Cork for the first time, going to Ireland for the first time, just shortly after I read this novel. This novel was so fascinating in terms of teaching me all kinds of things I did not know about Irish history. And it's also just a really good read.
You want to tell us about something coming up at the library on St. Patrick's Day?
Well, this is how we're going to be celebrating St. Patrick's Day at the Falmouth Public Library. Mark Derry, who is the biographer of Edward Gorey, a new book called Born to be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gorey, will be doing an illustrated talk about Edward Gorey and the biography on St. Patrick's Day at 2 o'clock. And, you know, Liam's right across the street from us, so you can come to the lecture
and then go have your green beer
across the street. It'll be great.
All right. We have a listener recommending Patrick McGinley's The Trick of the Gabalga. Did I say that right? Like McKinley's previous novels, this odd tale from rural 1940s Ireland combines bucolic setting, darkly violent undercurrents, and illicit sex. An Englishman who has stayed in Ireland as a retreat from life from World War II in particular, and has bought a stark little house and farm near the coast in Donegal, only to find himself in the midst of many strange happenings. This strange novel displays McKinley's distinctive gifts, its eccentric, charming, and uniquely overlapping of death, sex, and brooding scenery. And we will have a link to all of the books we talked about this morning at our website, capeandislands.org, a little later this afternoon. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Nelson O'Callaghan-Richel, who's the author of 5 books on Irish literature and professor of humanities at Mass Maritime. Thanks, you both. This was fun.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistants from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.